This is a special edition of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Happy New Year. For the past 3 years on Radio Boston, we've used New Year's Day as a moment to reflect on the past year. We call it our Producer's Picks show, meaning that each producer picks their favorite segment of the year. We hope that it gives you the opportunity to get to know the team behind the show. It also gives us the opportunity to take stock of the year and of the privilege that it is to be able to bring you the news every day. Normally, we're able to do it sitting around the table in the studio and listen to those favorites together, but all traditions have had to adapt in 2020, including this one. So this year, we're going to take a different approach. I will touch base with each of our five producers individually to hear about their favorites. And before we start, we want to acknowledge this has been an incredibly tough year for so many of us. In the show ahead, many of the producers' choices were moments when we were able to bring joy and meaning to the airwaves, starting with Paris Alston. Hey there, Paris.
Hey, Tiziana, how are you?
Doing great. Paris, what'd you bring for us today?
So I want to take us back to the time before Corona, if you can even imagine it, when we could have musical guests in studio. In January, we spoke to gospel artist Trey McLaughlin and his group Sounds of Zamar, who came to Boston all the way from Augusta, Georgia. Now, in addition to our interview, I also went to a singing workshop that the group put on in Cambridge, and that's how I saw Trey's personality really come to life.
When we get to it, just freeze. Very good. And control your vibrato, so I don't want to hear I want you to pull it straight, okay? Got it? We're going from the beginning of the phrase. Tenors and basses, continue to choose you this day.
I loved them, Paris, and I loved having that singing right in the studio. I do miss that. Why did you want us to revisit your interview with Trey?
Well, Tiziana, I loved them too, and I really couldn't stop thinking about Trey and his group. And honestly, going to that workshop was the highlight of my year because that was right before everything closed and shut down. But it was also one of those pre-COVID memories that I've really cherished and held on to because it was a time when we were able to gather and sing and meet new people. And honestly, I probably would have joined a choir if it wasn't for the pandemic. And Trey's actual interview really resonated with me because I'm also from the South, and gospel music has been a huge part of my life since I was a kid. And the music that we play in our interview with Trey are on the soundtrack to my life, everything from Kirk Franklin to Chance the Rapper. And honestly, gospel has really been getting me through this pandemic. I can tell you there's been many Sundays where I've woken up and tuned into my virtual church services while I was doing yoga. On first Sundays, I made sure I took my communion. I would get like a Ritz cracker or a Cheez-It and a little shot glass of wine, even though in this pandemic, I ended up going through the whole bottle. And in the process, I would be listening to my favorite old and new gospel songs.
Which is just coping, right? It's finding the way to get through.
Absolutely, absolutely. And as Trey McLaughlin explained, there are messages in gospels that can get anyone through. It doesn't just have to be people who identify with the faith tradition behind it.
It is for people of our same faith. It is for people of our same belief system, of course. But it's also for people who may not necessarily believe the same things that we believe, but who are looking for an experience or who are looking to come together, who are looking for unity. We want those people to be able to enjoy our music as well, because technically, for our faith or our belief system, we are here to engage all people.
When we were having this discussion earlier, one of the artists that we talked about was Chance the Rapper, who has been interesting in his career in crossing genres. Here's a little bit from a song called Finish Line, which is from 2016.
Get this money, get this budget, K-OK to take him. Me and my girl plan to stay to the end. Hope it never come a day where we be better as friends. We in a marathon, we could build a marathon. Arguments and spirits, they get deeper than a marathon.
Now, if I understand it, that actually segues eventually into some Kirk Franklin. Which is really interesting given
right.
And it seems like a dialogue between men, between genres, between messages, between generations.
Yes.
It strikes me in listening to your work, in listening to some of the music that we listened to prepare for today, that that dialogue is essential to what the music's about.
It's the most important thing. Community is the most important thing. that has always been the goal of music for African Americans, because that's been the goal of music for Africans. The community is there. The community is singing. It's not a performance. It is a community activity. And I think that we brought that same mentality here with us. So even as the slaves sung, they sung slave songs or work songs in the fields. It was about community. It was about unity. And sometimes they didn't even come from the same tribes. They didn't even speak the same languages. You know, music is transcendent. And I think community has always been the goal, even before we knew the sacred text.
You were here at a City Space event downstairs recently, and one of the people in the audience during the Q&A asked you if you would engage with a choir that was sitting in the audience in what's called call and response. Mm-hmm. Here it is.
I laid awake at night.
I laid awake at night.
And that's all right.
So just before you started the call and response, the questioner asked you, and you turned to the choir and said, "Do you know Trouble in My Way?" And some people looked like maybe they didn't know it. And you're like, "How can you not know Trouble in My Way?" But then you guys just kind of did it. It was a dialogue that was just an invitation to figure it out together.
Yeah.
And so much of the rest of the audience, if you watch that audience carefully, wants to be a part of it.
Yeah.
But they don't know how. Right, you see people kind of scooching in their seats, and they're wondering if they should sing along, and they're not really sure if they should clap. What holds us back with such a beautiful invitation?
I will tell you, I think Western music tradition holds us back. And not that there's anything wrong with it. There's not. Classical Western music tradition is of performance and audience. And typically, the audience does not join in the performance. They only experience it.
What do we lose?
We lose an opportunity to create community. Because what happens is, while we're all having the collective experience together, I think to actually join in and not just watch it transcends us. It takes us to another place. I think it's another level of connection.
So that's Trey McLaughlin, who came to Studio 3 back in February with the group Sounds of Zamar. And Paris, I also loved that Sounds of Zamar performed for us that day.
Yes, they did. And I love that, too. It was like a whole praise and worship session in Studio 3. And I believe we're going to go out on some of what they perform now.
We are. And that is Radio Boston producer Paris Alston. Paris, thank you.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Mama Mella, he lives in you.
Oh, he lives in me.
And we're going to have links so you can hear this segment and the others we discussed today on our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's so much more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is a special hour of Radio Boston. We are back on this special New Year's edition of Radio Boston, where we're looking back at some of our producers' favorite segments that they worked on in 2020. Now let's turn to producer Zoe Mitchell. Hey, Zoe.
Hey, Tiziana. Happy New Year.
Thank you. I am happy to leave 2020 behind. Happy New Year to you, too. Zoe, we seem to love our music segments this year, and you're going to bring us more music, right?
Yeah, I wanted to bring you a piece that I worked on about this innovative and unexpected opera production this year. So I started working on this story over the summer when I was kind of starting to feel a bit fatigued from basically living online for 5 months. Of course, now it's been longer than that, but you know, the news has been just unrelenting this year. And for me, you know, the arts is where I turn to for some solace. So I attended online performances, Zoom events, virtual trivias during that quarantine period. And they were all great. But when summer rolled around, I was really hungering for something different. And then I found out about these two young women who were staging an entire opera on Animal Crossing.
Okay, so for those who might maybe be unfamiliar with Animal Crossing.
So I'm not going to reveal too much because I want you to listen through the whole piece, but it is this video game series that I used to play all the time as a kid. And by kid, I mean like middle schooler. And now it's been having this very adult renaissance. You know, a lot of adults are reconnecting with this game. And the idea of that and the opera, it all just made me so happy. You know, I loved the nostalgia, the uniqueness, and the whimsy of really taking a centuries-old music tradition and staging it in this very comical, colorful virtual world. And when I spoke to the two creators, I also learned how it was this small story of resilience this year. These are young local artists using this extremely challenging time to find new ways to innovate, reach new audiences, and just find joy.
And it really is joyful. Let's listen to it.
Susie, pretty Susie, what's all this about? The geese are going barefoot, their shoes are worn out.
Sopranos Larissa Bainton and Celeste Pellegrino are playing the roles of Hansel and Gretel on a performance staged entirely with Nintendo's Animal Crossing.
Oh, how I wish Mother would only return.
So the stars are two video game characters with comically oversized heads, wide, colorful eyes, and adorable smiles plastered on their faces.
I think it's just goofy and charming and silly, and yeah, I think it's funny too. It's just like these little, like, baby-looking characters singing full opera.
That's Pellegrino. She and Bainton created the opera company Due Donne Productions while they were completing their master's degrees at New England Conservatory.
You're making me snort, don't be a bore.
The music is from German composer Engelbert Humperdinck. In case you've forgotten the fairy tale, it's about two young children lost in a forest who encounter a witch in a gingerbread house.
Just wait till you see the witch's house, the candy house.
19th century fairy tale operas and a modern video game may sound like opposites, but Pellegrino says combining the two felt natural.
Animal Crossing is where you get to design your own island world with fun, cute animated characters. It's kind of like The Sims, if you've ever played The Sims, where you're kind of in a other reality, but the characters are much more cute, I would say.
Animal Crossing has been around for about 20 years, but it's in the midst of a massive resurgence. The newest version, which came out in March, sold 13 million copies in the first 6 weeks of its release. It's part of why it can be difficult, even now, to get your hands on the Nintendo Switch console. A core part of the appeal is that the game allows players to be together virtually, in real time. That's what made the production possible. While they recorded the music separately, all of the performers were able to act out their roles through the game as their own Animal Crossing avatars.
When you watch the opera and you hear it, it sounds like these people are in the same room, and there's no visual reminder telling you that they're not. So it feels like this is performance that happened together. When you see the squares on Zoom, you know that they're not together. And the best part of live theater is experiencing something, I think, together.
That's Pellegrino again. Before the pandemic, Due Donne Productions was planning 3 in-person operas and received grants to help them employ about 40 singers. Now, the future for any in-person productions is uncertain, says Bainton.
It's been like a uniquely devastating experience, and that singing is like one of the most dangerous like things you can do. And it's kind of like put the whole industry in chaos.
Bainton is among many in the industry experimenting with how to perform and connect with audiences remotely.
The kind of traditional way to do it is great, but like these other kind of new, maybe weird ways of doing it are also exciting, I think. Like it's nice to be able to be like, look, it doesn't have to be this like one way that everyone kind of thinks of it.
And as Pellegrino points out, cartoons and opera have been intertwined for decades. It pops up in episodes of the 90s show Hey Arnold, in SpongeBob SquarePants, and of course, Looney Tunes and Bugs Bunny.
I feel like if you ask anyone, they're going to know the Ride of the Valkyrie theme. They might not know that's the name, but they'll know what it is in their head. So I don't think this is totally out of left field. That being said, I think the video game is just like the next generation of that kind of cartoon.
They hope that this approach to opera will draw non-traditional audiences. Pellegrino says they have also received positive responses from opera lovers. Bainton said the most powerful thing about the project was performing again with other people.
I think we all felt kind of emotional, like watching it for the first time and hearing all of our voices together. And we were like, oh my gosh, like it sounds like we're together even though we were apart.
I love that story. That's Radio Boston producer Zoe Mitchell speaking with Larissa Bainton and Celeste Pellegrino. Thanks for bringing us that today, Zoe.
Thank you. It was so great to share this with you today. And thanks for all you do, Tiziana.
Oh, thanks, Zoe. Next up is producer Jamie Bologna. Jamie, hi.
Hey, your chair's pretty comfy here.
Are you in my chair?
I am. I mean, keeping
you
it nice and comfy
in it
and warm.
Me.
Yep.
There you go. So what you got for us, Jamie?
So, Tiziana, I want to bring you just a few minutes that I spent with a Somerville cellist. His name is Michael Block, back in November. Block is the founder and director of this nonpartisan group. It was called Play for the Vote, which had planned to have some 600 musicians out doing live music for voters on Election Day. And he's also a member of Yo-Yo Ma's Silk Road Ensemble. And I met up with him at the Somerville Public Library Election Day morning.
We're at the Central Library here in Somerville, near where I live, and I'm going to be performing here at various peak voting times throughout the day.
You know, we might not see it here in Somerville, but of course folks are going to be out with signs and protesting around the country. I'm just wondering, from your perspective as a musician, as someone who's wants to bring this beautiful music to folks, how we as a country can bridge that divide.
An election is often a moment where we're focusing on the differences between candidates and the difference between our goals. And music really does have a unique power to bring people together through shared experiences, not just a shared experience of a concert, but shared emotional experiences. It can help us feel that connection to the people around us.
And Mike, you know, as voters line up here in Somerville, what do you hope that they take away from hearing your music today?
Life can be full of magical moments where we feel connected to the world around us and to the people around us. And I feel surprising moments of connection and music can really change somebody's perspective as to what's possible or what can be expected out of even an important day like today.
You're here playing against the hustle and bustle of Somerville. There's buses going by, construction vehicles. They're building a new high school nearby. It's less than 40 degrees out. Are these the circumstances under which you normally play your music?
Well, this isn't exactly where I envisioned my career would end up. But, you know, during this pandemic, musicians across the country were unable to play normal concerts. And so this day felt like a day where we could make the effort to go to where the people are going to be. This is not Symphony Hall, but it does feel great to be connected. You know, at some point, my daughter's going to be going to this high school that's under construction now, and I walk by this library often, and it's great to just feel connected to the community.
So a couple folks coming in here to vote, and they gave you the thumbs up. How does that feel?
Well, that's about as good as I could hope for today, yeah.
So, Jamie, why did you want us to listen back to this piece?
Tiziana, I don't think anyone needs me to observe this, but this year has been difficult and different for all of us.
Yeah.
And I think the average Radio Boston listener might not think about us producers every day and what we do to get this and all the other shows on this station on the air, unless on the sort of off occasion where we get to head out into the world and meet folks, talk to them, record them, and bring their voices and our own to the show. And that has been really hard to do this year, going out, meeting a stranger somewhere, getting to know them, hearing what they've got to say. you know, we've all been so scared of COVID, and we weren't initially sure how it even worked and how were we going to record people. And eventually we figured it out. And this little moment was really the moment that I personally got my courage back to go out there and meet a stranger again. And it was only then that I realized just how much I'd been missing it.
And Jamie, I mean, it just hits, right? It hits. I get that. But I think you also have a second part that you want us to listen back to.
Yes, today. If you'll indulge me, I've got a little more time left in my allotted slot here. In little Jamie time in this producer pick show. And I've been thinking a lot about this part of our work that's been stripped away and how meaningful it can be, those interactions that we're all starved for. And I thought back to someone that the city lost this year in August, Anthony Martinetti, the 63-year-old star of the 1969 Wednesday's Prince Spaghetti Day commercial. As you well know, I met up with him in 2019 to mark that commercial's 50th anniversary. But before that day, he too, like Mike Block, the cellist, was just a stranger that I cold called and asked for an interview. So I know this didn't air this year. Actually, this part has never aired. But in his honor, I'd like to bring you a bit of my conversation with Anthony Martinetti in the North End in 2019, because I think you'll hear just how humble of a person he was, and you'll hear the kindness that sort of emanated through him.
I never thought it was anything special. I still don't, you know? I mean, I'm just a normal guy. I don't brag about it. People, you know, when they ask me if... Where do I know you from? I say, I don't know, you know.
I don't know. You know, when I think about that ad, I'm really stunned to be here with you. So no. Thank you. But
don't be.
But I mean, it really is one of those iconic TV moments at night. And it's your name. I don't know if my name was yelled out a window.
Well, it is. Like, I mean, I remember people getting letters when I was, you know, my early teens or late teens. People say they named their kids after me, Anthony, and people saying, you know, my name's Anthony, and people, they stretch it out when they say it, you know. It's the same way they do you know, in the ad, they sing it. So he says, you know, my mother, you know, I couldn't go anywhere without people calling me the way your TV mom used to call you.
Did that bother you? Did that bug you?
No, it didn't bother me. I was like, you know, that's nice. You know, a lot of people, like it says, I named my son after you. That's an honor. You know, it's not like you made millions of dollars doing it. So there was an ad of, you know, 30 seconds of fame. That's all it was, but it lasted forever, like 50 years.
You know, for people who will listen to this on the radio and remember you, remember the ad, or maybe you've never even heard of it, what would your message be to them?
You'd always be nice to people because you never know what comes out of it. And that's what happened to me. If I was a punk to those people that asked me for directions, they wouldn't have picked me. I wasn't anything special or had anything special. I was just a regular kid, like thousands of us back in those days. They could have picked anybody, but they picked me because I was nice to them. If I was a brat to them, like my friends were, they wouldn't have picked me. So always be kind to people because you never know. There's always somebody up there watching over us.
So how about this, Anthony? I'll see you here in 25 years?
I hope so.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
It was nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you too, my friend.
Thanks for that, Jamie. And of course, you're not going to be able to meet up with him in 24 years.
24 years now. Yeah, no, I certainly won't. And I know that so many of our listeners are mourning friends and family members, colleagues that they've lost in this pandemic. And I know it's hard, and so for me, listening back to Anthony and hearing him there at the end call me his friend, that just means a lot to me. To have encountered his spirit of kindness and generosity, really the generosity of a stranger. I'd only met him once on that one day in the fall of 2019, but just that kindness is one of the many things that's carrying me through this year, and one of the things that gives me hope for next year and the chance to hopefully meet new strangers for this show and to bring you their stories and their voices.
Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna. Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is a special hour of Radio Boston. Thank you. is our Producers Picks show. All this hour, we've been checking in with each of our producers about their favorite segments they produced in 2020. And next up is producer and regular guest, whenever we check the score, Chris Siderick. Chris!
Hey, Tiziana.
So, Chris, I am going to go out on a limb here and guess that you picked us some sports.
Oh, you cheated. No, this is actually interesting. This is our third year doing the show, and I actually haven't picked a sports segment yet. This is the first year I've done that. But I just think this year sports has really been such a source of joy and connection and community for so many, including myself. And I just felt that it was something that really spoke to me. So I did, fair enough, reach into the bag of sports segments we've done and come up with one of my favorites.
Okay, so you and I have talked a lot of sports this year. What did you pick?
We have. And speaking of that joy, I picked, I think, maybe the most joyous segment I've ever been a part of here on Radio Boston. And it is when we relived the great moments of Boston sports history.
Yeah.
This is back in the early days of the pandemic when there were no live sports. There was nothing to watch. We had spent weeks kind of, those of us who would consider ourselves sports fans, getting a little itchy, looking for a game somewhere. So we were kind of digging into history and looking for those great games and moments to relive.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, the reason I picked this segment and specifically this set of moments in that segment is because I am a huge fan of anytime we get a little peek behind the curtain. You know, we try so hard to be objective professional journalists here day in and day out. And I don't know if you remember the segment, but a certain Anthony Brooks, that would be WBUR's senior political reporter and diehard Red Sox fan, Anthony Brooks, let us in on a moment where he let all of that go right out the window. And I just thought it was so much fun to hear him reflect back on that.
So let's listen to it. Here is Anthony Brooks talking about being in the building for Game 4 of the 2004 ALCS, which ultimately paved the way for the Red Sox to win their first World Series title in 86 years.
So I was there for NPR and WBUR. But here's the thing. As you said, I am a Sox fan, and I was doing my best to kind of display a kind of professional detachment like a professional journalist is supposed to do. It was also getting late. It was also getting cold. I also had sort of given up on the idea that the Red Sox had a chance to win this game. But there they were, tied in the bottom of the 12th inning. So every time a Red Sox hitter would come up to the plate, I'd walk out right along the box, the grandstand area along the third base line, and turn on my tape recorder. Just in case something amazing happened, I would get the sound of Fenway Park erupting. So there on the bottom of the 12th, they're tied up. Ortiz is up at the plate, and sure enough, he swings hard and sends the ball right into, I think it was the visitor's bullpen. Fenway erupts, pandemonium, huge cheers. I'm recording the whole thing, and this is fantastic news. So then I get back to the studio to record my piece and put it together for NPR, and I think we have a clip to play from
yes.
that moment.
Let's do it right here.
Okay.
Ortiz blasted Quantrill's pitch into the Yankee bullpen, circled the bases, and jumped into the arms of his ecstatic teammates at home plate.
What was the screaming, Anthony?
So that very front of scenes, you know, yeah, that was me. That was me.
The consummate
professional. Professional detachment gone. And I had a long moment listening to the tape thinking, oh, my God, I can't use this because I'm screaming all over my tape like an idiotic Red Sox fan. But I decided that it was drowned out enough by 37,000 other people. But once you know that story and listen to that tape, it's pretty clearly me screaming all over that
tape. I mean, Anthony, back me up here. Something about that game is because the Red Sox had every reason to mail it in, basically, to just say, it's not our year, not going to happen, everything's against us, we'll try again next year. And it was the fact that they kept playing, they were scrappy, they just kept fighting when they had every excuse to give it up. I think that's what gave it the weight that moment really had. What do you think?
It's true. And I honestly, this sounds cliche, but there were a lot of people. I mean, there were 37,000 people there that evening, and a lot of them hadn't given up. Because I remember interviewing some fans when they were at the beginning of the game. And I talked to these guys, I forget where they're from, but the Boston area, and one of them said, we got nothing to worry about. we're going to win tonight. We're going to win three more. We're going to go down to New York and beat them there. And, you know, we've got this under control. And I sort of took the tape away and thought, yeah, right.
This is before Boston was title town. Like, this is
all right. You've had your moment. I've got one I want to put in here, too. Anthony Brooks, thanks so much for joining us for that. That was a riot. Okay, so I've got one for you. We're going to fast forward to 2013 now, okay? Because this is a special memory in our family. It's the 2013 ALCS, the American League Championship Series. Yes, I know what that stands for. Thank you very much. Sox are playing.
When that, you're in the World Series.
That's right. Sox are playing the Tigers, which you also have to understand. My husband and I were both born and raised in Michigan. So there's a special.
I forgot about the Detroit connection here.
There's a special tension to playing the Tigers. It's game two. Now, this was the year that the Tigers had pitching that should have just shut down all of
baseball.
Absolute
nasty rotation.
Yeah. So the Sox had been one hit by Anibal Sanchez in game one. And Justin Verlander was waiting to what one would assume is destroy.
Cy Young candidate, right? Justin Verlander. Yeah.
So in game three. So we're in game two. And Max Scherzer, who has been great, is pitching. The Sox are down 5-1. We're in the eighth inning. But suddenly we start getting runners on bases. Will Mitterbrooks, Dustin Pedroia. My husband and my daughter, Stephen Simone, the ones who couldn't go yesterday, are watching, and they tell this story. They're sitting there waiting to see what happens, and all of a sudden, Big Poppy comes to the plate to hit against the closer for Detroit, who they bring in to shut him down.
Bases loaded. Two out.
Wait for it.
The Grand Slam.
There it is. Grand Slam.
Mr. Clutch.
Right. Grand Slam. So now we're tied. We go into the ninth inning, and just to put the cherry on it, at some point Simone had stood on one foot. She was 11 at the time. So the two of them decided that you must, right? This is baseball. So they watch the ninth inning standing on one foot.
They would be bad fans if
they
did
not. And the Sox come back and win it. And as you well know, what happened at the end of 2013?
World Series.
That's right.
Absolutely. And I want to point out that game you're talking about, that home run. That is the cop moment with
the cop
holding his hands up in the bullpen, who has now become a Boston celebrity.
That's right. If you don't know what Chris is talking about, you use your memory. You've seen somewhere a picture with two legs in the air.
Because Torrey Hunter,
the outfielder from the Tigers, goes over the wall, and his legs are up in the air next to the arms of the bullpen police officer who is cheering the grand slam.
Another consummate professional.
There you go. So, Chris, that was such a great segment, and we got a lot of great feedback on that segment, and I find that really striking because, of course, sports is something visual, and yet it was the sound of all of that that made it so magical. What do you think that's about?
Well, it goes back to what I was talking about at the beginning of this segment. It's just sports has a real power to connect us to each other. For me, it's an excuse to text my dad. You know what I mean? There are just these moments that we will never forget where we were when we experienced them. And there are these stories that we get to be a part of, even though we're not there on the field. We're a part of the story, a part of the journey. And I think that segment really captured that joy and sense of community, which is something we needed so badly this year.
And that is Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick. Chris, great choice. Thanks for bringing that to us.
Thanks for having me, TD.
Last but not least is producer Walter Wuthman. Hey there, Walt.
Hey, Tiziana.
All right, so you are up. What do you have for us?
So, Tiziana, it's been such a dark year. I wanted to end with something a little joyful, and that seems to be kind of a running theme through all of our picks for this show. But as you know, before all of this hit, I was working on a project documenting hidden sacred spaces around Boston, which was a project between WBUR, Brandeis University, in San Francisco-based Walking Cinema. So the final piece in that series is about a synagogue at a senior home in Roslindale. And I wanted to revisit it because my experience there and the people I met really blew me away.
I am really glad you picked this one, Walt. The sound of these older adults singing, I remember it actually managed to break and heal my heart all at once when I heard them.
Yeah. So just to give a little more background before we listen to it, Hebrew Senior Life is a historically Jewish senior home right at the edge of the Arnold Arboretum. And the chaplain there created this really unique Friday music service where the residents come gather in the synagogue to sing reggae music. Now, obviously, they've had to cancel these services because of the coronavirus. So putting this piece together was really bittersweet, you know, reconstructing these moments of joy, which don't happen anymore. But one thing before we start, and this is something I heard from the chaplain, apparently, the residents featured in the story all had their radios turned on at the same time when it aired live. So as it played, you could hear their singing sort of echoing through the hallways of the senior home, and it kind of brought that moment back to life for them.
Oh. All right, so let's listen.
So Edith, are you ready?
Edith is 89-year-old Edith Klein Dreiser. She's sitting in the front row of the synagogue, getting ready for her solo.
Right now, I have cough drops in my mouth.
It's okay.
I'm going to sing.
Klein Dreiser bears a striking resemblance to her idol, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Upstairs in my room, on the door, I have the picture of the Ginsburg lady.
The musicians are warming up near the front of the room. Once they're ready to go, it's time for Edith's big moment.
Ready, Edith? No worry.
Don't worry
about a thing.
About a thing.
Cause every little thing gonna be alright.
Gonna be alright.
Until you don't.
I really wanted to sing that song, and it's repetitive. And to me, it says what Shabbat is about, which is everything's gonna be alright.
That's Hallie Diachadue, the creator of the sing-along and Hebrew Senior Life's chaplain. Diachadue used to only hold a Kabbalat Shabbat on Friday afternoons, the traditional Jewish evening service. But they say they wanted to create a musical service beforehand that could appeal to residents of different faiths. Bob Marley was their inspiration.
You've got this moment in time, everything is going to be all right. And so I changed some of the words, And then I started saying it was the anniversary of Bob Marley's bar mitzvah. And, you know, the people with dementia were like, oh, all right.
And it works for Mary Robichaud. She's a Catholic who lives at the senior center and has been coming to the singing services for the past year.
My son calls her Francis. They say, where's Mary? She's in the synagogue. He said, oh, Mother of God, help us. She's in the synagogue praying.
Dozens of staff from the senior center accompany the residents, many of whom cannot walk down to the synagogue themselves.
Music is very important. It's very important to me, especially gospel music.
Activities coordinator Philippa Robitaux says she grew up in Belize listening to gospel music. And those songs now help her unwind at the end of her shifts. Her favorite, Since I Laid My Burden Down. She told Diachadue about it. Now it's part of the Friday service.
Music is very, very important in the patient life because some patient may not respond to nothing. And the minute they hear music, their eyes could be closed, but you can see their hands or their feet moving.
Many of the patients at Hebrew Senior Life have dementia. But staff seem to agree that music helps them connect to feelings and memories when language can't.
Seeing them go and really soak it in is amazing because of their disease, you know, as opposed to someone who really knows that I'm going to the synagogue. But music is universal.
Yeah, it is universal.
That's Susan Kalinda, one of the nurse managers on a dementia floor.
Yeah, we're doing something good for them. Mm-hmm. For them going out there and seeing who knows what they're feeling when they are in that presence of the synagogue. Mm-hmm. It's definitely different from this routine. So it does good for them.
Susan says she and her team are always looking for ways to connect with their patients. She says about half her floor grew up speaking Russian, so she and her staff are learning Russian.
Yes, dobro otra, dobro day, that's good morning or good afternoon.
Jati bele blue, I love you. That's my number one that I always learn, Jati bele blue. I love that set of phrase.
That's Kalinda, who grew up in Uganda, and Yvette Robinson from Panama. In many ways, Hebrew Senior Life reflects the larger demographics of elder care in America. Immigrants from places like Haiti, Panama, Uganda, and Samoa fill a disproportionate role in caring for an aging, mostly white population. It's hard work, physically and emotionally. Hallie Diachadue says they keep this in mind as they try to be a chaplain for both the residents and the staff in a place where death is a constant part of life and dealing with it is part of the job.
We sustain over 150 deaths a year. So people are they're opening their hearts and loving these people and then getting their hearts broken almost every day. So they're coming to me with that. They're coming to me with, how do I love the next person who moves into that bed? Because we are a spiritual organization, but we're also a business. So that bed is going to be filled the next day.
Nurse Yvette Robinson says that's the hardest part.
You feel a part of you is gone. And that's a hard thing that we have, you know, we wish everybody could be alive, but it ain't like that. And we wish the disease wasn't like this, but it ain't like that. This is part of life, so we have to learn how to deal with it. And it's not a beautiful process, but we're there. At least we know that we did our part to at least bring a little joy in life.
One of those joys, every Friday, people like Yvette and Susan wheel patients down to the synagogue to sing. In this space, this odd family from all corners of the world comes together to connect with something universal.
That story from Radio Boston's Walter Withman. Walt, thanks.
Thank you.
We want to end today with our executive producer, our fearless leader, Hitesh Hathi. Hey there, Hitesh.
Hello, Tiziana.
So, Hitesh, it's a little different this year. Normally, actually, I don't do anything with producer's picks. Normally, it's your opportunity to sit in Studio 3 with the whole team and have a conversation that really kind of pulls back the curtain for our listeners on what the team does and what's important to the team in making the show. Are you missing that opportunity this year? What do you lose when you don't get to do that with the team?
It's funny, of course, when you say, are you missing it and what do you lose? I immediately think of the bigger thing of what we've lost this year, what we miss. And, you know, the fact is I just miss being in the studio and in our offices every day with all of our colleagues, but especially our team and you. And yes, this is particular fun. But I have to tell you, I started doing it in an interim period where we didn't have a full-time host. So in fact, what I'm feeling most is grateful not to be doing it and having a great host here to do it.
Thank you, Hitesh. You know, I wonder, you know these segments so well. These are segments that our producers, you know, produced throughout 2020. So they're the umpteenth time you've heard them. Do you learn something new when you hear the producer talk about that segment for themselves and listen to it again in that light?
Well, so this is the thing, you know, every time you listen to anything, you think, oh gosh, there's that. And that pause was more meaningful than I thought. And isn't it interesting they worded it that way and I didn't quite notice it. So every time is a learning experience, and these segments that we choose, you know, they're the richest. And so there's so much in there. They all bear multiple listenings. But our producers, they're always thinking, they're always growing and keeping me growing. So every time I listen to them talk about segments that we've done, whether it's theirs or another segment, it always makes me stop and say, gosh, that's interesting. That'll be worth keeping in mind. Gosh, how smart a thought that is. And that's where I find myself. You must too, actually.
I do. And, you know, as we create these segments, you get so much of the producer's mind, right? Their heart and how they're thinking about the challenge or the news segment or the joy that we're bringing that day. I don't know if listeners know how much of the producer is in each of these segments. Hitesh, you know, I was thinking, your experience as a producer, a senior producer, an executive producer, this is a chance to peel back the curtain for our listeners a little bit. Do you have any way to help our listeners understand just how unprecedented doing this show and covering the news has been in 2020?
So this is a year which has been a very, very difficult year for everyone. And there's never been a year where we've had to do, or any extended period where we've had to do what we had to do this year. To be living in the midst of one of the most difficult stories to even get the dimensions of. On a day-to-day basis, scientists, epidemiologists, politicians, everyone was unsure. Where were we? How large was this going to be? How deep an effect was it going to have in our social lives, in our economy, in our fundamental health, education? What will it mean? And I think we've just begun to understand the dimensions of this. But there's a way in which you can also see it maybe as a kind of grace. You know, so I'm going somewhere where I hadn't imagined, but in the religious tradition in which I come, there's this idea when in the old days, this hardly exists in the modern world anymore, when people had a serious case of the pox, they often, if they survived, they had pock marks on their skin, especially on their face. And it was called, the word for it was divine grace, because it was a reminder of how fragile the world is, how thin the line between what you think is a stable life and some other thing that you can't imagine. A way to remember that there's something bigger and more mysterious in life. You know, it's not just an Indian thought. There's an American poet who wrote, "In a dark time, the eye begins to see. I meet my shadow in the deepening shade." And I think both the pandemic and the reckoning with our racial history has made us see some truths about ourselves. The pandemic has laid bare inequality, injustice, as well as reserves of kindness and generosity and grace. Mm. And I think, if I think of what my job is as an editor for this show, it's an odd way to think about the news, but my job is to make sure that the curtain which was pulled back, you know, is a curtain that we don't let fall again, that in our coverage we keep in mind what we have seen, the problems of our society, what individuals face, and we also keep in mind the extraordinary reserves of strength we have as individuals, as a community, and to keep covering those, yes, with skepticism, yes, with all journalistic fact-checking. But those are kind of the twin poles, and maybe that's been a gift of this year.
Well, I hope it's a year that you've been proud of, Hitesh. That's our executive producer, Hitesh Hathi, helping us close this special show on Producer Picks. Hitesh, thanks.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Our engineer today is Glenn Alexander, and we want to send a big thanks to him and all the engineering help we've had this past year, Marquise Neal, Jimmy Kiesling, Renee Marchando, and a special thanks to our longtime technical director, Tim Skog, who has moved on from Radio Boston. Tim brought the show to life with his creativity, his musical mastery, and his technical expertise. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston. Thank you.